waterline, the other two close together amidships, underneath her floorboards in the bottom. The ballast had been shifted, too, was lying loose. And that's not all. The seacocks had been turned on.
The seacocks? What are they? Asked the coroner.
The fitting that plugs the pipes leading from a wash basin or lavatory, sir. Mrs. De Winter had a little place fitted up right aft. And there was a sink forward, where the washing up was done. There was a seacock there, and another in the lavatory. These are always kept tight closed when you're underway, otherwise the water would flow in. When I examined the boat yesterday, both seacocks were turned full on.
It was hot. Much too hot. Why didn't they open a window? We should be suffocated if we sat here with the air like this. And there were so many people, all breathing the same air. So many people.
With those holes in her planking, sir, and the seacocks not closed, it wouldn't take long for a small boat like her to sink. Not much more than 10 minutes, I should say. Those holes weren't there when the boat left my yard. I was proud of my work, and so was Mrs. De Winter. It's my opinion, sir, that the boat never capsized at all. She was deliberately scuttled.
I must try and get out of the door. I must try and go back to the waiting room again. There was no air left in this place, and the person next to me was pressing close, close. Someone in front of me was standing up, and they were talking, too. They were all talking. I did not know what was happening. I could not see anything. It was hot, so very hot. The coroner was asking everybody to be silent, and he said something about Mr. De Winter. I could not see. That woman's hat was in front of me. Maxim was standing up now. I could not look at him. I must not look at him. I felt like this once before. When was it? I don't know. I don't remember. Oh, yes, with Mrs. Danvers, the time Mrs. Danvers stood with me by the window. Mrs. Danvers was in this place now, listening to the coroner. Maxim was standing up over there. The heat was coming up at me from the floor, rising in slow waves. It reached my hands, wet and slippery. It touched my neck, my chin, my face.
Mr. De Winter, you heard the statement from James Tabb, who had the care of Mrs. De Winter's boat. Do you know anything of these holes driven in the planking?
Nothing whatever.
Can you think of any reason why they should be there?
No, of course not.
It's the first time you've heard them mentioned.
Yes.
It's a shock to you, of course.
It was shock enough to learn that I made a mistake in identification over 12 months ago, and now I learn that my late wife was not only drowned in the cabin of her boat, but that holes were bored in the boat with the deliberate intent of letting in the water so that the boat should sink. Does it surprise you that I should be shocked?
No, Maxim. No, you will put his back up. You heard what Frank said. You must not put his back up. Not that voice, not that angry voice, Maxim. He won't understand. Please, darling, please. Oh, God, don't let Maxim lose his temper. Don't let him lose his temper.
Mr. De Winter, I want you to believe that we all feel very deeply for you in this matter. No doubt you have suffered a shock, a very severe shock, in learning that your late wife was drowned in her own cabin and not at sea, as you supposed. And I am inquiring into the matter for you. I want, for your sake, to find out exactly how and why she died. I don't conduct this inquiry for my own amusement.
That's rather obvious, isn't it?
I hope that it is. James Tabb has just told us that the boat which contained the remains of the late Mrs. De Winter had 3 holes hammered through her bottom, and that the seacocks were open. Do you doubt his statement?
Of course not. He's a boat builder. He knows what he's talking about.
Who looked after Mrs. De Winter's boat?
She looked after it herself.
She employed no hand?
No, nobody at all.
The boat was moored in the private harbour belonging to Manderley?
Yes.
Any stranger who tried to tamper with the boat would be seen. There is no access to the harbour by public footpath.
No, none at all.
The harbour is quiet, is it not, and surrounded by trees?
Yes.
A trespasser might not be noticed.
Possibly not.
Yet James Tabb has told us, and we have no reason to disbelieve him, that a boat with those holes drilled in her bottom and the seacocks open could not float for more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Quite.
Therefore, we can put aside the idea that the boat was tampered with maliciously before Mrs. De Winter went for her evening sail. Had that been the case, the boat would have sunk at her moorings.
No doubt.
Therefore, we must assume that whoever took the boat out that night drove in the planking and opened the seacocks.
I suppose so. You have told us already that the door of the cabin was shut, the portholes closed, and your wife's remains were on the floor. This was in your statement, and in Dr. Phillips's, and in Captain Searle's.
Yes.
And now, added to this, is the information that a spike was driven through the bottom and the seacocks were open. Does not this strike you, Mr. De Winter, as being very strange?
Certainly.
You have no suggestion to make?
No, none at all.
Mr. De Winter, painful as it may be, it is my duty to ask you a very personal question.
Yes?
Were relations between you and the late Mrs. De Winter perfectly happy?
They had to come, of course. Those black spots in front of my eyes, dancing, flickering, stabbing the hazy air. And it was hot. So hot. With all these people, all these faces, and no open window. The door, from being near to me, was farther away than I had thought, and all the time the ground coming up to meet me. And then, out of the queer mist around me, Maxim's voice, clear and strong.
"Will someone take my wife outside? She is going to faint."
Chapter 23. I was sitting in the little room again, the room like a waiting room at the station. The policeman was there, bending over me, giving me a glass of water, and someone's hand was on my arm. Frank's hand. I sat quite still, the floor, the walls, the figures of Frank and the policeman, taking solid shape before me. "I'm so sorry," I said. "Such a stupid thing to do. It was so hot in that room. So very hot."
"It gets very airless in there," said the policeman. "There's been complaints about it often, but nothing's ever done. We've had ladies fainting in there before."
"Are you feeling better, Mrs. De Winter?" said Frank.
"Yes, yes, much better. I shall be all right again. Don't wait with me."
"I'm going to take you back to Manderley."
"No."
"Yes, Maxim has asked me to."
"No, you ought to stay with him."
"Maxim told me to take you back to Manderley."
He put his arm through mine and helped me to get up.
"Can you walk as far as the car, or shall I bring it round?"
"I can walk. But I'd much rather stay. I want to wait for Maxim."
"Maxim may be a long time."
Why did he say that? What did he mean? Why didn't he look at me? He took my arm and walked with me along the passage to the door, and so down the steps into the street. "Maxim may be a long time."
We did not speak.
We came to the little Morris car belonging to Frank. He opened the door and helped me in. Then he got in himself and started up the engine. We drove away from the cobbled marketplace through the empty town and out onto the road to Kerith. "Why will they be a long time? What are they going to do?"
"They may have to go over the evidence again."
Frank looked straight in front of him along the hard white road. "They've had all the evidence," I said. "There's nothing more anyone can say."
"You never know," said Frank.
"The coroner may put his questions in a different way. Tab has altered the whole business. The coroner will have to approach it now from another angle."
"What angle? How do you mean?"
"You heard the evidence. You heard what Tab said about the boat. They won't believe in an accident any more."
"It's absurd, Frank. It's ridiculous. They should not listen to Tab. How can he tell after all these months how holes came to be in a boat? What are they trying to prove?"
"I don't know."
"That coroner will go on and on harping at Maxim, making him lose his temper, making him say things he doesn't mean. He will ask question after question, Frank, and Maxim won't stand it. I know he won't stand it."
Frank did not answer. He was driving very fast. For the first time since I had known him, he was at a loss for the usual conventional phrase. That meant he was worried, very worried. And usually he was such a slow, careful driver, stopping dead at every crossroads, peering to right and left, blowing his horn at every bend in the road. "That man was there," I said. "That man who came once to Manderley to see Mrs. Danvers."
"You mean Favell?" asked Frank.
"Yes, I saw him."
"He was sitting there with Mrs. Danvers."
"Yes, I know."
"Why was he there? What right had he to go to the inquest?"
"He was her cousin.
It's not right that he and Mrs. Danvers should sit there listening to that evidence. I don't trust them, Frank.
No.
They might do something. They might make mischief.
Again, Frank did not answer. I realized that his loyalty to Maxim was such that he would not let himself be drawn into a discussion, even with me. He did not know how much I knew, nor could I tell for certainty how much he knew. We were allies. We traveled the same road, but we could not look at one another. We neither of us dared risk a confession. We were turning in now at the lodge gates and down the long, twisting, narrow drive to the house. I noticed for the first time how the hydrangeas were coming into bloom, their blue heads thrusting themselves from the green foliage behind. For all their beauty, there was something sombre about them, funereal. They were like the wreaths, stiff and artificial, that you see beneath glass cases in a foreign churchyard. There they were, all the way along the drive on either side of us, blue, monotonous, like spectators lined up in a street to watch us pass.
We came to the house at last, and rounded the great sweep before the steps. "Will you be all right now?" said Frank. "You can lie down, can't you?"
"Yes," I said. "Yes, perhaps."
"I shall go back to Lanyon," he said. "Maxim may want me."
He did not say anything more. He got quickly back into the car again and drove away. Maxim might want him. Why did he say Maxim might want him? Perhaps the coroner was going to question Frank as well. Ask him about that evening over 12 months ago when Maxim had dined with Frank. He would want to know the exact time that Maxim left his house. He would want to know if anybody saw Maxim when he returned to the house. Whether the servants knew that he was there. Whether anybody could prove that Maxim went straight up to bed and undressed. Mrs. Danvers might be questioned. They might ask Mrs. Danvers to give evidence. And Maxim beginning to lose his temper. Beginning to go white.
I went into the hall. I went upstairs to my room and lay down upon my bed, even as Frank had suggested. I put my hands over my eyes. I kept seeing that room and all the faces. The lined, painstaking, aggravating face of the coroner, the gold pince-nez on his nose.
"I don't conduct this inquiry for my own amusement," his slow, careful mind easily offended.
What were they all saying now? What was happening? Suppose in a little while Frank came back to Manderley alone. I did not know what had happened. I did not know what people did. I remembered pictures of men in the papers leaving places like that and being taken away. Suppose Maxim was taken away. They would not let me go to him. They would not let me see him. I should have to stay here at Manderley day after day, night after night, waiting as I was waiting now. People like Colonel Julian being kind, people saying, "You must not be alone, you must come to us." The telephone, the newspapers. The telephone again. "No, Mrs. de Winter can't see anyone. Mrs. de Winter has no story to give the County Chronicle." And another day, and another day. Weeks that would be blurred and non-existent. Frank at last taking me to see Maxim. He would look thin, queer, like people in hospital. Other women had been through this. Women I had read about in papers. They sent letters to the Home Secretary, and it was not any good. The Home Secretary always said that justice must take its course. Friends sent petitions, too. Everybody signed them. But the Home Secretary could never do anything. And the ordinary people who read about it in the papers said, why should the fellow get off? He murdered his wife, didn't he? What about the poor murdered wife? This sentimental business about abolishing the death penalty simply encourages crime. This fellow ought to have thought about that before he killed his wife. It's too late now. He will have to hang for it like any other murderer. And serve him right, too. Let it be a warning to others.
I remember seeing a picture on the back of a paper once, of a little crowd collected outside a prison gate, and just after 9 o'clock a policeman came and pinned a notice on the gate for the people to read. The notice said something about the sentence being carried out. Sentence of death was carried out this morning at 9 o'clock. The governor, the prison doctor, and the sheriff of the county were present. Hanging was quick. Hanging did not hurt. It broke your neck at once. No, it did not. Someone said once it did not always work.
someone who had known the governor of a prison. They put that bag over your head and you stand on the little platform, and then the floor gives way beneath you. It takes exactly 3 minutes to go from the cell to the moment you are hanged. No, 50 seconds, someone said. No, that's absurd. It could not be 50 seconds. There's a little flight of steps down the side of the shed, down to the pit. The doctor goes down there to look. They die instantly. No, they don't. The body moves for some time. The neck is not always broken. Yes, but even so, they don't feel anything. Someone said they did. Someone who had a brother who was a prison doctor said it was not generally known because it would be such a scandal. But they did not always die at once. Their eyes were open. They stay open for quite a long time. God, don't let me go on thinking about this. Let me think about something else, about other things. About Mrs. Van Hopper in America. She must be staying with her daughter now. They had that house on Long Island in the summer. I expect they played a lot of bridge. They went to the races. Mrs. Van Hopper was fond of the races. I wonder if she still wears that little yellow hat. It was too small for her, much too small on that big face. Mrs. Van Hopper sitting about in the garden of that house on Long Island, with novels and magazines and papers on her lap. Mrs. Van Hopper putting up her lorgnette and calling to her daughter, "Look at this, Helen. They say Max de Winter murdered his first wife. I always did think there was something peculiar about him. I warned that fool of a girl she was making a mistake, but she wouldn't listen to me. Well, she's cooked her goose now, all right. I suppose they'll make her a big offer to go on the pictures."
Something was touching my hand. It was Jasper. It was Jasper thrusting his cold, damp nose in my hands. He had followed me up from the hall. Why did dogs make one want to cry? There was something so quiet and hopeless about their sympathy. Jasper, knowing something was wrong, as dogs always do, trunks being packed, cars being brought to the door, dogs standing with drooping tails, dejected eyes, wandering back to their baskets in the hall when the sound of the car dies away. I must have fallen asleep, because I woke suddenly with a start and heard that first crack of thunder in the air. I sat up. The clock said 5. I got up and went to the window. There was not a breath of wind. The leaves hung listless on the trees, waiting. The sky was slaty grey. The jagged lightning split the sky. Another rumble in the distance. No rain fell. I went out into the corridor and listened. I could not hear anything. I went to the head of the stairs. There was no sign of anybody. The hall was dark because of the menace of thunder overhead. I went down and stood on the terrace. There was another burst of thunder. One spot of rain fell on my hand. One spot, no more. It was very dark. I could see the sea beyond the dip in the valley, like a black lake. Another spot fell on my hands, and another crack of thunder came. One of the housemaids began shutting the windows in the rooms upstairs. Robert appeared and shut the windows of the drawing room behind me. "The gentlemen are not back yet, are they, Robert?" I asked. "No, madam, not yet. I thought you were with them, madam." "No, no, I've been back some time. Will you have tea, madam?" "No, no, I'll wait. It looks as though the weather was going to break at last, madam." "Yes." No rain fell. Nothing since those 2 drops on my hand. I went back and sat in the library. At 5:30, Robert came into the room. "The car has just driven up to the door now, madam," he said. "Which car?" I said. "Mr. De Winter's car, madam," he said. "Is Mr. De Winter driving it himself?"
"Yes, madam."
I tried to get up, but my legs were things of straw. They would not bear me. I stood leaning against the sofa. My throat was very dry. After a minute, Maxim came into the room. He stood just inside the door. He looked very tired, old. There were lines at the corner of his mouth I had never noticed before.
"It's all over," he said.
I waited. Still I could not speak or move towards him.
"Suicide," he said, "without sufficient evidence to show the state of mind of the deceased. They were all at sea, of course. They did not know what they were doing."
I sat down on the sofa. "Suicide," I said. "But the motive? Where was the motive?"
"God knows," he said. "They did not seem to think a motive was necessary. Old Horridge peering at me, wanting to know if Rebecca had any money troubles. Money troubles, God in heaven!"
He went and stood by the window, looking out at the green lawns. "It's going to rain," he said. "Thank God it's going to rain at last."
"What happened?" I said. "What did the coroner say? Why have you been there all this time?"
"He went over and over the same ground again," said Maxim. "Little details about the boat that no one cared about a damn. Were the seacocks hard to turn on? Where exactly was the first hole in relation to the second? What was ballast? What effect upon the stability of the boat would the shifting of the ballast have? Could a woman do this unaided? Did the cabin door shut firmly? What pressure of water was necessary to burst open the door?" I thought I should go mad. I kept my temper, though. Seeing you there by the door made me remember what I had to do. If you had not fainted like that, I should never have done it. It brought me up with a jerk. I knew exactly what I was going to say. I faced Horridge all the time. I never took my eyes off his thin, pernickety little face and those gold-rimmed pince-nez. I shall remember that face of his to my dying day. I'm tired, darling. So tired I can't see or hear or feel anything. He sat down on the window seat. He leant forward, his head in his hands. I went and sat beside him. In a few minutes Frith came in, followed by Robert carrying the table for tea. The solemn ritual went forward, as it always did, day after day, the leaves of the table pulled out, the legs adjusted, the laying of the snowy cloth, the putting down of the silver teapot and the kettle with the little flame beneath, scones, sandwiches, three different sorts of cake. Jasper sat close to the table, his tail thumping now and again upon the floor, his eyes fixed expectantly on me. It's funny, I thought, how the routine of life goes on, whatever happens. We do the same things, go through the little performance of eating, sleeping, washing. No crisis can break through the crust of habit. I poured out Maxim's tea. I took it to him on the window seat, gave him his scone, and buttered one for myself. "Where's Frank?" I asked.
"He had to go and see the vicar. I would have gone too, but I wanted to come straight back to you. I kept thinking of you waiting here all by yourself, not knowing what was going to happen."
"Why the vicar?" I said.
"Something has to happen this evening," he said. "Something at the church."
I stared at him blankly. Then I understood. They were going to bury Rebecca. They were going to bring Rebecca back from the mortuary.
"It's fixed for 6:30, he said. "No one knows but Frank and Colonel Julian and the vicar and myself. There won't be anyone hanging about. This was arranged yesterday. The verdict doesn't make any difference."
"What time must you go?"
"I'm meeting them there at the church at 6:25.
I did not say anything. I went on drinking my tea. Maxim put his sandwich down, untasted.
"It's still very hot, isn't it?" he said.
"It's the storm," I said. "It won't break, only little spots at a time. It's there in the air. It won't break."
"It was thundering when I left Lanyon," he said. "The sky was like ink over my head. Why in the name of God doesn't it rain?"
The birds were hushed in the trees. It was still very dark. "I wish you did not have to go out again," I said. He did not answer. He looked tired, so deathly tired.
"We'll talk over things this evening when I get back," he said presently. "We've got so much to do together, haven't we? We've got to begin all over again. I've been the worst sort of husband for you."
"No," I said. "No."
"We'll start again once this thing is behind us. We can do it, you and I. It's not like being alone. The past can't hurt us if we're together. You'll have children, too."
After a while, he glanced at his watch.
"It's 6:10, he said. "I shall have to be going. It won't take long, not more than half an hour. We've got to go down to the crypt."
I held his hand. "I'll come with you. I shan't mind. Let me come with you."
"No," he said. "No, I don't want you to come." Then he went out of the room.
I heard the sound of the car starting up in the drive. Presently the sound died away, and I knew he had gone. Robert came to clear away the tea. It was like any other day. The routine was unchanged. I wondered if it would have been so had Maxim not come back from Lanyon.
I wondered if Robert would have stood there, that wooden expression on his young sheep's face, brushing the crumbs from the snow-white cloth, picking up the table, carrying it from the room. It seemed very quiet in the library when he'd gone. I began to think of them down at the church, going through that door and down the flight of stairs to the crypt. I had never been there. I had only seen the door. I wondered what a crypt was like, if there were coffins standing there, Maxim's father and mother. I wondered what would happen to the coffin of that other woman who had been put there by mistake. I wondered who she was, poor, unclaimed soul, washed up by the wind and tide. Now another coffin would stand there. Rebecca would lie there in the crypt as well. Was the vicar reading the burial service there, with Maxim and Frank and Colonel Julian standing by his side? Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. It seemed to me that Rebecca had no reality any more. She had crumbled away when they had found her on the cabin floor. It was not Rebecca who was lying in the crypt. It was dust. Only dust. Just after 7, the rain began to fall. Gently at first, a light pattering in the trees, and so thin I could not see it. Then louder and faster, a driving torrent falling slantways from the slate sky, like water from a sluice. I left the windows open wide. I stood in front of them and breathed the cold, clean air. The rain splashed into my face and on my hands. I could not see beyond the lawns. The falling rain came thick and fast. I heard it sputtering in the gutter pipes above the window and splashing on the stones of the terrace. There was no more thunder. The rain smelt of moss and earth and of the black bark of trees. I did not hear Frith come in at the door. I was standing by the window watching the rain. I did not see him until he was beside me. "Excuse me, madam," he said. "Do you know if Mr. De Winter will be long?" "No," I said, "not very long." "There's a gentleman to see him, madam," said Frith after a moment's hesitation. "I'm not quite sure what I ought to say. He's very insistent about seeing Mr. De Winter." "Who is it?" I said. "Is it anyone you know?" Frith looked uncomfortable. "Yes, madam," he said. "It's a gentleman who used to come here frequently at one time, when Mrs. De Winter was alive, a gentleman called Mr. Favell." I knelt on the window seat and shut the window. The rain was coming in on the cushions. Then I turned round and looked at Frith. "I think perhaps I had better see Mr. Favell," I said. "Very good, madam." I went and stood over on the rug beside the empty fireplace. It was just possible that I should be able to get rid of Favell before Maxim came back. I did not know what I was going to say to him, but I was not frightened. In a few moments Frith returned and showed Favell into the library. He looked much the same as before, but a little rougher, if possible, a little more untidy. He was the sort of man who invariably went hatless. His hair was bleached from the sun of the last days, and his skin was deeply tanned. His eyes were rather bloodshot. I wondered if he had been drinking. "I'm afraid Maxim is not here," I said. "I don't know when he will be back. Wouldn't it be better if you made an appointment to see him at the office in the morning?"
"Waiting doesn't worry me," said Favell, "and I don't think I shall have to wait very long, you know. I had a look in the dining room as I came along, and I see Max's place is laid for dinner all right."
"Our plans have been changed," I said. "It's quite possible Maxim won't be home at all this evening."
"He's run off, has he?" said Favell,
with a half-smile I did not like.
"I wonder if you really mean it. Of course, under the circumstances, it's the wisest thing he can do. Gossip is an unpleasant thing to some people. It's more pleasant to avoid it, isn't it?"
"I don't know what you mean," I said.
"Don't you?" he said. "Oh, come. You don't expect me to believe that, do you? Tell me, are you feeling better? Too bad fainting like that at the inquest this afternoon. I would have come and helped you out, but I saw you had one knight errant already. I bet Frank Crawley enjoyed himself. Did you let him drive you home? You wouldn't let me drive you 5 yards when I offered to."
"What do you want to see Maxim about?" I asked. Favell leant forward to the table and helped himself to a cigarette.
"You don't mind my smoking, I suppose," he said. "It won't make you sick, will it? One never knows with brides."
He watched me over his lighter.
"You've grown up a bit since I saw you last, haven't you?" he said. "I wonder what you've been doing, leading Frank Crawley up the garden path."
He blew a cloud of smoke in the air.
"I say, do you mind asking old Frith to get me a whiskey and soda?"
I did not say anything. I went and rang the bell. He sat down on the edge of the sofa, swinging his legs, that half-smile on his lips.
Robert answered the bell. "A whiskey and soda for Mr. Favell," I said.
"Well, Robert," said Favell, "I haven't seen you for a very long time, still breaking the hearts of the girls in Kerith."
Robert flushed. He glanced at me, horribly embarrassed.
"All right, old chap, I won't give you away. Run along, get me a double whiskey and jump on it."
Robert disappeared. Favell laughed, dropping ash all over the floor.
"I took Robert out once on his half-day," he said. "Rebecca bet me a fiver I wouldn't ask him. I won my fiver, all right. Spent one of the funniest evenings of my life. Did I laugh? Oh, boy! Robert on the razzle takes a lot of beating, I tell you. I must say he's got a good eye for a girl. He picked the prettiest of the bunch we saw that night."
Robert came back again with the whiskey and soda on a tray. He still looked very red, very uncomfortable. Favell watched him with a smile as he poured out his drink, and then he began to laugh, leaning back on the arm of the sofa. He whistled the bar of a song, watching Robert all the while.
"That was the one, wasn't it?" he said. "That was the tune. Do you still like ginger hair, Robert?"
Robert gave him a flat, weak smile. He looked miserable. Favell laughed louder still. Robert turned and went out of the room.
"Poor kid," said Favell. "I don't suppose he's been on the loose since. That old ass Frith keeps him on a leading string."
He began drinking his whiskey and soda, glancing round the room, looking at me every now and again, and smiling.
"I don't think I shall mind very much if Max doesn't get back to dinner," he said. "What say you?"
I did not answer. I stood by the fireplace, my hands behind my back.
"You wouldn't waste that place at the dining-room table, would you?" he said.
He looked at me, smiling still, his head on one side. "Mr. Favell," I said, "I don't want to be rude, but as a matter of fact, I'm very tired. I've had a long and fairly exhausting day. If you can't tell me what you want to see Maxim about, it's not much good your sitting here. You would far better do as I suggest and go round to the estate office in the morning." He slid off the arm of the sofa and came towards me, his glass in his hand.
"No. No," he said. "No, no, don't be a brute. I've had an exhausting day, too. Don't run away and leave me. I'm quite harmless, really I am. I suppose Max has been telling tales about me to you."
I did not answer.
"You think I'm the big bad wolf, don't you?" he said. "But I'm not, you know. I'm perfectly ordinary, harmless bloke, and I think you're behaving splendidly over all this, perfectly splendidly. I take off my hat to you, I really do."
This last speech of his was very slurred and thick. I wished I had never told Frith I would see him.
"You come down here to Manderley," he said, waving his arm vaguely. "You take on all this place, meet hundreds of people you've never seen before. You put up with old Max and his moods. You don't give a fig for anyone. You just go your own way. I call it a damn good effort. And I don't care who hears me say so. A damn good effort."
He swayed a little as he stood. He steadied himself and put the empty glass down on the table.
"This business has been a shock to me, you know," he said. "A bloody awful shock. Rebecca was my cousin. I was damn fond of her."
"Yes," I said, "I'm very sorry for you."
"We were brought up together," he went on, "always tremendous pals. Liked the same things, the same people, laughed at the same jokes. I suppose I was fonder of Rebecca than anyone else in the world, and she was fond of me. All this has been a bloody shock."
"Yes," I said. "Yes, of course."
"And what is Max going to do about it? That's what I want to know. Does he think he can sit back quietly now that sham inquest is over? Tell me that."
He was not smiling any more. He bent towards me.
"I'm going to see justice is done to Rebecca," he said, his voice growing louder. "Suicide, God almighty, that doddering old fool of a coroner got the jury to say suicide. You and I know it wasn't suicide, don't we?"
He leant closer to me still.
"Don't we?" he said, slowly.
The door opened, and Maxim came into the room, with Frank just behind him. Maxim stood quite still with the door open, staring at Favell.
"What the hell are you doing here?" he said.
Favell turned round, his hands in his pockets. He waited a moment and then began to smile.
"As a matter of fact, Max, old chap, I came to congratulate you on the inquest this afternoon." "Do you mind leaving the house?" said Max. "Or do you want Crawley and me to chuck you out?" "Steady a moment, steady a moment," said Favell.
He lit another cigarette and sat down once more on the arm of the sofa.
"You don't want Frith to hear what I'm going to say, do you?" he said. "Well, he will, if you don't shut that door."
Maxim did not move. I saw Frank close the door very quietly.
"Now listen here, Max," said Fabel. "You've come very well out of this affair, haven't you? Better than you ever expected. Oh, yes. I was in the court this afternoon, and I dare say you saw me. I was there from start to finish. I saw your wife faint at a rather critical moment, and I don't blame her. It was touch and go then, wasn't it, Max? What way the inquiry would go. And luckily for you, it went the way it did. You hadn't squared those thick-headed fellows who were acting jury, had you? Looked damn like it to me."
Maxim made a move towards Favel, but Favel held up his hand.
"Wait a bit, can't you?" he said. "I haven't finished yet. You realize, don't you, Max, old man, that I can make things damned unpleasant for you if I choose. Not only unpleasant, but shall I say dangerous?"
I sat down on the chair beside the fireplace. I held the arms of the chair very tight. Frank came over and stood behind the chair. Still, Maxim did not move. He never took his eyes off Favel.
"Oh, yes," he said. "In what way can you make things dangerous?"
"Look here, Max," said Favel. "I suppose there are no secrets between you and your wife, and from the look of things, Crawley there just makes the happy trio. I can speak plainly then, and I will. You all know about Rebecca and me. We were lovers, weren't we? I've never denied it, and I never will. Very well, then. Up to the present, I believed, like every other fool, that Rebecca was drowned sailing in the bay, and that her body was picked up at Edgecombe weeks afterwards. It was a shock to me then, a bloody shock. But I said to myself, that's the sort of death Rebecca would choose. She'd go out like she lived, fighting."
He paused. He sat there on the edge of the sofa, looking at all of us in turn.
"Then I pick up the evening paper a few days ago, and I read that Rebecca's boat had been stumbled on by the local diver, and that there was a body in the cabin. I couldn't understand it. Who the hell would Rebecca have as a sailing companion? It didn't make sense. I came down here and put up at a pub just outside Kerith. I got in touch with Mrs. Danvers. She told me then that the body in the cabin was Rebecca's. Even so, I thought, like everyone else, that the first body was a mistake, and Rebecca had somehow got shut in the cabin when she went to fetch a coat. Well, I attended that inquest today, as you know, and everything went smoothly, didn't it, until Tab gave his evidence. But after that, well, Max, old man, what have you got to say about those holes in the floorboards and those seacocks turned full on?"
"Do you think," said Maxim slowly, "that after those hours of talk this afternoon, I am going into it again with you? You heard the evidence and you heard the verdict. It satisfied the coroner and it must satisfy you."
"Suicide, eh?" said Favel. "Rebecca committing suicide. The sort of thing she would do, wasn't it? Listen. You never knew I had this note, did you? I kept it because it was the last thing she ever wrote to me. I'll read it to you. I think it will interest you."
He took a piece of paper out of his pocket. I recognized that thin, pointed, slanting hand. "I tried to ring you from the flat, but could get no answer," he read. "I'm going down to Manders right away. I shall be at the cottage this evening, and if you get this in time, will you get the car and follow me? I'll spend the night at the cottage and leave the door open for you. I've got something to tell you, and I want to see you as soon as possible. Rebecca." He put the note back in his pocket.
"That's not the sort of note you write when you're going to commit suicide, is it?" he said. "It was waiting for me at my flat when I got back about 4 in the morning. I had no idea Rebecca was to be in London that day, or I should have got in touch with her. It happened by a vile stroke of fortune. I was on a party that night. When I read the note at 4 in the morning, I decided it was too late to go crashing down on a 6-hour run to Manderley. I went to bed, determined to put a call through later in the day. I did, about 12 o'clock, and I heard Rebecca had been drowned."
He sat there, staring at Maxim. None of us spoke.
"Supposing the coroner this afternoon had read that note, it would have made it a little bit more tricky for you, wouldn't it, Max, old man?" said Favel.
"Well," said Maxim, "why didn't you get up and give it to him?"
"Steady, old boy. Steady. No need to get rattled. I don't want to smash you, Max. God knows you've never been a friend to me, but I don't bear malice about it. All married men with lovely wives are jealous, aren't they? And some of them just can't help playing Othello. Huh. They're made that way. I don't blame them. I'm sorry for them. I'm a bit of a socialist in my way, you know, and I can't think my fellows can't share their women instead of killing them. What difference does it make? You can get your fun just the same. A lovely woman isn't like a motor tire. She doesn't wear out. The more you use her, the better she goes. Now, Max, I've laid all my cards on the table. Why can't we come to some agreement? I'm not a rich man. I'm too fond of gambling for that. But what gets me down is never having any capital to fall back on. Now, if I had a settlement of 2,000 or 3,000 a year for life, I could jog along comfortably and I'd never trouble you again. I swear before God I would not.
I've asked you before to leave the house, said Maxim. I'm not going to ask you again. There's the door behind me. You can open it yourself.
Half a minute, Maxim, said Frank. It's not quite so easy as all that. He turned to Favell. I see what you're driving at. It happens, very unfortunately, that you could, as you say, twist things round and make it difficult for Maxim. I don't think he sees it as clearly as I do. What is the exact amount you propose Maxim should settle on you? I saw Maxim go very white, and a little pulse began to show on his forehead.
Don't interfere with this, Frank, he said. This is my affair entirely. I'm not going to give way to blackmail.
I don't suppose your wife wants to be pointed out as Mrs. de Winter, the widow of a murderer, of a fellow who was hanged, said Favell.
He laughed and glanced towards me.
You think you can frighten me, don't you, Favell, said Maxim. Well, you are wrong. I'm not afraid of anything you can do. There is the telephone in the next room. Shall I ring up Colonel Julian and ask him to come over? He's the magistrate. He'll be interested in your story.
Favell stared at him and laughed.
Good bluff, he said, but it won't work. You wouldn't dare ring up old Julian. I've got enough evidence to hang you, Max, old man.
Maxim walked slowly across the room and passed through to the little room beyond. I heard the click of the telephone. Stop him, I said to Frank. Stop him, for God's sake. Frank glanced at my face. He went swiftly towards the door. I heard Maxim's voice, very cool, very calm.
I want Kerith 17, he said.
Favell was watching the door, his face curiously intense.
Leave me alone, I heard Maxim say to Frank, and then 2 minutes afterwards. Is that Colonel Julian speaking? It's de Winter here. Yes, yes, I know. I wonder if you could possibly come over here at once. Yes, to Manderley. It's rather urgent. I can't explain why on the telephone, but you shall hear everything directly you come. I'm very sorry to have to drag you out. Yes. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
He came back into the room.
Julian is coming right away, he said.
He crossed over and threw open the windows. It was still raining very hard. He stood there with his back to us, breathing the cold air. Maxim, said Frank quietly. Maxim? He did not answer. Favell laughed and helped himself to another cigarette.
If you want to hang yourself, old fellow, it's all the same to me, he said.
He picked up a paper from the table and flung himself down on the sofa, crossed his legs and began to turn over the pages. Frank hesitated, glancing from me to Maxim. Then he came beside me. Can't you do something, I whispered. Go out and meet Colonel Julian. Prevent him from coming. Say it was all a mistake. Maxim spoke from the window without turning round.
Frank is not to leave this room, he said. I'm going to manage this thing alone. Colonel Julian will be here in exactly 10 minutes.
We none of us said anything. Favell went on reading his paper. There was no sound but the steady falling rain. It fell without a break, steady, straight, and monotonous. I felt helpless, without strength. There was nothing I could do. Nothing that Frank could do. In a book or in a play, I would have found a revolver, and we should have shot Favell, hidden his body in a cupboard. There was no revolver. There was no cupboard. We were ordinary people. These things did not happen. I could not go to Maxim now and beg him on my knees to give Favell the money. I had to sit there with my hands in my lap, watching the rain, watching Maxim with his back turned to me, standing by the window. It was raining too hard to hear the car. The sound of the rain covered all other sounds. We did not know Colonel Julian had arrived until the door opened and Frith showed him into the room. Maxim swung round from the window.
"Good evening," he said. "We meet again. You've made very good time." "Yes," said Colonel Julian. "You said it was urgent, so I came at once. Luckily, my man had left the car handy." "What an evening!"
He glanced at Favelle uncertainly, and then came over and shook hands with me, nodding to Maxim.
"A good thing the rain has come," he said. "It's been hanging about too long. I hope you're feeling better."
I murmured something, I don't know what, and he stood there, looking from one to the other of us, rubbing his hands.
"I think you realize," said Maxim, "that I haven't brought you out on an evening like this for a social half-hour before dinner. This is Jack Favelle, my late wife's first cousin. I don't know if you have ever met."
Colonel Julian nodded.
"Your face seems familiar. I probably met you here in the old days." "Quite," said Maxim. "Go ahead, Favelle."
Favelle got up from the sofa and chucked the paper back on the table. The 10 minutes seemed to have sobered him. He walked quite steadily. He was not smiling any longer. I had the impression that he was not entirely pleased with the turn in the events, and he was ill-prepared for the encounter with Colonel Julian. He began speaking in a loud, rather domineering voice.
"Look here, Colonel Julian," he said. "There's no sense in beating about the bush. The reason why I'm here is that I'm not satisfied with the verdict given at the inquest this afternoon."
"Oh," said Colonel Julian. "Isn't that for De Winter to say, not you?"
"No, I don't think it is," said Favelle. "I have a right to speak, not only as Rebecca's cousin, but as her prospective husband, had she lived."
Colonel Julian looked rather taken aback.
"Oh," he said. "Oh, I see. That's rather different. Is this true, De Winter?"
Maxim shrugged his shoulders. "It's the first I've heard of it," he said.
Colonel Julian looked from one to the other doubtfully.
"Look here, Favelle," he said. "What exactly is your trouble?"
Favelle stared at him a moment. I could see he was planning something in his mind, and he was still not sober enough to carry it through. He put his hand slowly in his waistcoat pocket and brought out Rebecca's note.
"This note was written a few hours before Rebecca was supposed to have set out on that suicidal sail. Here it is. I want you to read it and say whether you think a woman who wrote that note had made up her mind to kill herself."
Colonel Julian took a pair of spectacles from a case in his pocket and read the note. Then he handed it back to Favelle.
"No," he said, "on the face of it, no. But I don't know what the note refers to. Perhaps you do. Or perhaps De Winter does."
Maxim did not say anything. Favelle twisted the piece of paper in his fingers, considering Colonel Julian all the while.
"My cousin made a definite appointment in that note, didn't she?" he said. "She deliberately asked me to drive down to Manderley that night because she had something to tell me. What it actually was, I don't suppose we shall ever know, but that's beside the point. She made the appointment, and she was to spend the night in the cottage on purpose to see me alone. The mere fact of her going for a sail never surprised me. It was the sort of thing she did for an hour or so after a long day in London. But to put plug holes in the cabin and deliberately drown herself, the hysterical, impulsive freak of a neurotic girl, oh, no, Colonel Julian, by Christ, no!"
The colour had flooded into his face, and the last words were shouted. His manner was not helpful to him, and I could see by the thin line of Colonel Julian's mouth that he had not taken to Favelle.
"My dear fellow," he said, "it's not the slightest use your losing your temper with me. I'm not the coroner who conducted the inquiry this afternoon, nor am I a member of the jury who gave the verdict. I'm merely the magistrate of the district. Naturally, I want to help you all I can, and De Winter, too. You say you refuse to believe your cousin committed suicide. On the other hand, you heard, as we all did, the evidence of the boatbuilder. The seacocks were open, the holes were there. Very well. Suppose we get to the point. What do you suggest really happened?"
Favelle turned his head and looked slowly towards Maxim. He was still twisting the note between his fingers.
"Rebecca never opened those seacocks, nor split the holes in the planking. Rebecca never committed suicide. You've asked for my opinion, and by God, you shall have it. Rebecca was murdered. And if you want to know who the murderer is, why, there he stands, by the window there, with that goddamn superior smile on his face. He couldn't even wait, could he, until the year was out before marrying the first girl he set eyes on. There he is, there's your murderer for you, Mr. Maximilian de Winter. Take a good, long look at him. He'd look well hanging, wouldn't he?
And Favell began to laugh, the laugh of a drunkard, high-pitched, forced, and foolish, and all the while twisting Rebecca's note between his fingers. Chapter 24. Thank God for Favell's laugh. Thank God for his pointing finger, his flushed face, his staring, bloodshot eyes. Thank God for the way he stood there swaying on his 2 feet, because it made Colonel Julian antagonistic. It put him on our side. I saw the disgust on his face, the quick movement of his lips. Colonel Julian did not believe him. Colonel Julian was on our side. "The man's drunk," he said quickly. "He doesn't know what he's saying."
"Drunk, am I?" shouted Favell. "Oh, no, my fine friend. You may be a magistrate and a colonel into the bargain, but it won't cut any ice with me. I've got the law on my side for a change, and I'm going to use it. There are other magistrates in this bloody county besides you, fellows with brains in their heads who understand the meaning of justice. Not soldiers who got the sack years ago for incompetence and walk about with a string of putty medals on their chest. Max de Winter murdered Rebecca, and I'm going to prove it."
"Wait a minute, Mr. Favell," said Colonel Julian quietly. "You were present at the inquiry this afternoon, weren't you? I remember you now. I saw you sitting there. If you felt so deeply about the injustice of the verdict, why didn't you say so then to the jury, to the coroner himself? Why didn't you produce that letter in court?" Favell stared at him and laughed.
"Why?" he said. "Because I did not choose to, that's why. I preferred to come and tackle de Winter personally."
"That's why I rang you up," said Maxim, coming forward from the window. "We've already heard Favell's accusations. I asked him the same question. Why didn't he tell his suspicions to the coroner? He said he was not a rich man, and that if I cared to settle 2,000 or 3,000 on him for life, he would never worry me again. Frank was here, and my wife. They both heard him. Ask them." "It's perfectly true," said Frank. "It's blackmail, pure and simple." "Yes, of course," said Colonel Julian. "The trouble is that blackmail is not very pure, nor is it particularly simple. It can make a lot of unpleasantness for a great many people. Each blackmailer finds himself in jail at the end of it. Sometimes innocent people find themselves in jail as well. We want to avoid that in this case." "I don't know whether you are sufficiently sober, Favell, to answer my questions, and if you keep off irrelevant personalities, we may get through with the business quicker. You have just made a serious accusation against de Winter. Have you any proof to back that accusation?"
"Proof?" said Favell. "What the hell do you want with proof? Aren't those hells in the boat proof enough?"
"Certainly not," said Colonel Julian, "unless you can bring a witness who saw him do it. Where's your witness?"
"Witness be damned," said Favell. "Of course de Winter did it. Who else would kill Rebecca?"
"Kerith has a large population," said Colonel Julian. "Why not go from door to door making inquiries? I might have done it myself. You appear to have no more proof against de Winter there than you would have against me."
"Oh, I see," said Favell. "You're going to hold his hand through this. You're going to back de Winter. You won't let him down because you've dined with him and he's dined with you. He's a big name down here. He's the owner of Manderley, you poor, bloody little snob."
"Take care, Favell. Take care."
"You think you can get the better of me, don't you? You think I've got no case to bring to a court of law. I'll get my proof for you, all right. I tell you, de Winter killed Rebecca because of me. He knew I was her lover. He was jealous, madly jealous. He knew she was waiting for me at the cottage on the beach, and he went down that night and killed her. Then he put her body in the boat and sank her."
"Quite a clever story, Favell, in its way, but I repeat again, you have no proof.
Produce your witness who saw it happen, and I might begin to take you seriously. I know that cottage on the beach, a sort of picnic place, isn't it? Mrs. De Winter used to keep the gear there for the boat. It would help your story if you could turn it into a bungalow with 50 replicas alongside of it. There would be a chance then that one of the inhabitants might have seen the whole affair.
Hold on, said Favell slowly. Hold on. There is a chance De Winter might have been seen that night. Quite a good chance, too. It's worth finding out. What would you say if I did produce a witness?
Colonel Julian shrugged his shoulders. I saw Frank glance inquiringly at Maxim. Maxim did not say anything. He was watching Favell. I suddenly knew what Favell meant. I knew who he was talking about. And in a flash of fear and horror, I knew that he was right. There had been a witness that night. Little sentences came back to me. Words I had not understood. Phrases I believed to be the fragments of a poor idiot's mind.
"She's down there, isn't she? She won't come back again." "I didn't tell no one. They'll find her there, won't they? The fishes have eaten her, haven't they? She'll not come back no more."
Ben knew. Ben had seen. Ben, with his queer, crazed brain, had been a witness all the time. He had been hiding in the woods that night. He had seen Maxim take the boat from the moorings and pull back in the dinghy alone. I knew all the colour was draining away from my face. I leant back against the cushion of the chair.
"There's a local halfwit who spends his time on the beach," said Favell. "He was always hanging about when I used to come down and meet Rebecca. I've often seen him. He used to sleep in the woods or on the beach when the nights were hot. The fellow's cracked. He would never have come forward on his own, but I could make him talk if he did see anything that night. And there's a bloody big chance he did."
"Who is this? What's he talking about?" said Colonel Julian.
"He must mean Ben," said Frank, with another glance at Maxim.
"He's the son of one of our tenants, but the man's not responsible for what he says or does. He's been an idiot since birth."
"What the hell does that matter?" said Favell. "He's got eyes, hasn't he? He knows what he sees. He's only got to answer yes or no. You're getting windy now, aren't you? Not so mighty confident."
"Can we get hold of this fellow and question him?" asked Colonel Julian. "Of course," said Maxim. "Tell Robert to cut down to his mother's cottage, Frank, and bring him back." Frank hesitated. I saw him glance at me out of the tail of his eye.
"Go on, for God's sake," said Maxim. "We want to end this thing, don't we?"
Frank went out of the room. I began to feel the old nagging pain beneath my heart. In a few minutes, Frank came back again into the room. "Robert's taken my car," he said. "If Ben is at home, he won't be more than 10 minutes.
"The rain will keep him at home, all right," said Favell. "He'll be there, and I think you will find I shall be able to make him talk."
He laughed and looked at Maxim. His face was still very flushed. Excitement had made him sweat. There were beads of perspiration on his forehead. I noticed how his neck bulged over the back of his collar, and how low his ears were set on his head. Those florid good looks would not last him very long. Already he was out of condition, puffy. He helped himself to another cigarette.
"You're like a little trade union here at Mandley, aren't you?" he said. "No one going to give anyone else away. Even the local magistrate is on the same racket. We must exempt the bride, of course. A wife doesn't give evidence against her husband. Crawley, of course, has been squared. He knows he would lose his job if he told the truth, and if I guess rightly, there's a spice of malice in his soul towards me, too. You didn't have much success with Rebecca, did you, Crawley? That garden path wasn't quite long enough, eh? It's a bit easier this time, isn't it? The bride will be grateful for your fraternal arm every time she faints. When she hears the judge sentence her husband to death, that arm of yours will come in very handy."
It happened very quickly. Too quick for me to see how Maxim did it, but I saw Favell stagger and fall against the arm of the sofa and down onto the floor, and Maxim was standing just beside him. I felt rather sick. There was something degrading in the fact that Maxim had hit Favell. I wished I had not known. I wished I had not been there to see. Colonel Julian did not say anything. He looked very grim. He turned his back on them and came and stood beside me.
"I think you had better go upstairs," he said quietly.
I shook my head. "No," I whispered. "No.
That fellow is in a state capable of saying anything, he said. What you have just seen was not very attractive, was it? Your husband was right, of course.